board, and I was asked to introduce our speaker today. Our speaker is Mr. Joseph Sirincione, and we agreed that I would introduce him very briefly, only with a passing reference to his undergraduate days at Boston College, given that my daughter-in-law is an undergraduate now at USF, a sister institution on the other side of the continent. Joseph Sirincione is a senior fellow and director for the nuclear policy at the Center for American Progress. If you haven't heard of it, just wait. It's 5 years old, like CG, but it's growing extraordinarily. It has already 125 people, and, you know, the buzz is essentially that this is a bipartisan response to the American Enterprise Institute. Good idea, and, you know, set to grow, certainly very much in the immediate future, given the electoral cycle, in what has been called here, for lack of a better word, and this is a Portuguese-speaking, the neighbor south of the border. So, Joe, you know, you were for a long time at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You were there for 8 years, and then you decided to be part of this vibrant new think tank. You have an experience in the U.S. House of Representatives, and you are the author of over 200 articles on defense issues. My background is in finance. I think finance and defense should embrace each other. Please, Joe, come here.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much, George. That was just wonderful. Obviously, please continue eating. I will talk through the clearing and through the plating of the dessert. It's really a pleasure for me to be here. And first of all, I want to thank the organizers of this event, not just Trevor Finlay, who invited me here, but the staff that has put this event together. This is one of the best organized conferences I have ever attended, and I do this for a living. I organize these things. This is fabulous. Thank you very much, the entire staff. This is just great. And thank you for hosting it in this your gorgeous building. It's just beautiful to be here. Although I do have an overwhelming desire for a glass of good whiskey. I don't think I could actually work here. but it's very nice. And, of course, I want to thank Jim Vasili for both starting this organization and hosting this conference, and for the last 2.5 years of my life, where I've had a BlackBerry for the first time, it has just changed my life. I work twice as hard as I ever used to, and just the maps function alone has made me finally be able to convince my wife that I really don't have to stop and ask directions. I know where I'm going. Thank you. Let's turn to the subject at hand. The fact of global warming caused by human activity can no longer be denied. The need for urgent action can no longer be delayed. This is not just an environmental issue. It is highly likely that in 10 years, global warming will be the number one national security issue facing many, perhaps all, countries. Nuclear power may play a role in preventing the worst of the global warming scenarios, but not the way it is currently structured. In addition to the serious problems of cost, safety, and waste, the nuclear industry has failed to solve the proliferation problem connected with nuclear power. Thus, the two great moral and technological challenges of our time are joined: global warming and nuclear proliferation. Both are caused by machines that we constructed. Both threaten to destroy most, maybe all, life on Earth. Both require our leaders to embrace and adopt comprehensive solutions, and both can be reversed. But in our desire to prevent one, we can't make the other one worse. If nuclear power is to play a role in combating global warming, we must make the world safe for nuclear power. It is grossly irresponsible to proceed with the construction of hundreds of new reactors that would require many new uranium enrichment facilities, and if some have their way, plutonium reprocessing facilities, thus bringing many new states right to the edge of nuclear weapons capability. This is a recipe for disaster. We must finally implement and complete a thorough reform of the fuel cycle that has been envisioned for decades, but been beyond the ability of politicians and policymakers to implement. Change is in the air. New proposals for how to solve these issues are proliferating. President George Bush said years ago that no new country need construct a uranium enrichment or plutonium reprocessing facility. IAEA Director Mohammed El-Baradei has a very comprehensive proposal for an international fuel bank that would assure countries of a fuel supply for whatever reactors they might build. These two platforms have to become part of any new solution. No new national plant construction and international control of existing capabilities. If we're going to have a nuclear renaissance, it has got to be a nuclear renaissance that helps prevent, not stimulates, nuclear proliferation. Let me explain. Many of you in the audience know far better than I. The problem is not the nuclear reactor. The problem is what goes into and what comes out of the nuclear reactor. The same facilities that can enrich fuel for to low levels for insertion in nuclear reactors can also be used to enrich it to high levels for nuclear bombs. Same facilities, you tweak the plumbing a bit, you go from fuel to bombs. The same facilities that can reprocess that spent fuel for waste storage or possibly fuel for new types of reactors can also be used to extract the plutonium that forms the core of nuclear weapons. Plutonium, highly enriched uranium, your two bomb materials, integral to the fuel cycle for nuclear power. This becomes an issue as you start to contemplate the expansion of nuclear power. If you were to try to solve global warming with nuclear power alone, that is, build enough plants to solve the carbon emission problem, we'd be talking about 7,800 reactors, or about 3 a week for every week for the next 50 years. You would need 100 Yucca Mountains to store the waste generated by those plants. But nobody's saying that that's the way we go. Most people talk about nuclear power being one of the wedges. Again, many of you know this better than I do. One of the 8 or 10 wedges that you need, technologies or policies that we adopt now whose impact grows over time. And for nuclear power to be one of those wedges, we're really talking about the construction of perhaps 700 plants, plus replacing the 435 plants already in existence, or building about 2 plants every month for the next 50 years. Still, in that scenario, you need 10 Yucca Mountains to store the waste. Now, this waste problem is, by itself, is an extremely difficult issue. I've been to Nevada. Chamber of Commerce Republicans, environmental Democrats are united on this. No, not in our backyard. Remember, the majority leader of the U.S. Senate is from Nevada. I honestly don't think that that facility is going to open. This is a huge problem. The sewer is backing up. We need a geological depository. I don't know if we're going to get one. This is a serious problem. That's just one of the issues, but it's not my issue. It's not something that I know that much about. I'm worried about the proliferation part of this. What do we do about the proliferation issue? The problem is already developing and maybe faster than most people realize. So this uranium enrichment facility, plutonium reprocessing facility, this is at the core of the issue with Iran. They are constructing at Natanz a facility of what they hope to be 50,000 centrifuges for what they say is a fuel plant. Do you believe them? Do you trust them? Can we allow them to build that, knowing that someday they might decide they're going to leave the nonproliferation treaty and turn it over to a bomb plant with 50,000 centrifuges? They could make a bomb's worth of material in a matter of weeks. That's the problem. Other countries are already talking about new uranium enrichment facilities. Brazil, South Korea, Ukraine, Australia. Other countries have already started reacting to the Iranian situation. If you believe that Iran is going to get a bomb or is close to getting a bomb, what do you do if you're Saudi Arabia, the Shia, the Sunni Arab rival of this Shia Persian state, or Egypt, a country that used to have a nuclear weapons program, or Turkey? I'll tell you what you do. You're already doing it. In the last 12 months, 12 Muslim nations have suddenly expressed an interest in having nuclear power programs. Egypt has announced a plan for the construction of 6 new reactors. Turkey has announced a plan for 3 nuclear reactors. Saudi Arabia and the states of the Gulf Cooperation Council have announced plans for a nuclear desalinization facility. Let's get this straight. In the entire Middle East, there is one nuclear power plant. That's the one under construction in Bushehr in Iran. In all of Africa, there are 2. Those are in South Africa. Suddenly, 62 years after the dawn of the nuclear age, these countries are interested in nuclear power facilities. This is not about energy. This is a nuclear hedge against Iran. This is the way proliferation spreads, neighbor to neighbor. These countries are starting a nuclear programs to acquire what they know is a long-term effort to develop these technologies, develop the infrastructure. It takes decades to go from the level that, say, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, or Egypt are at to a position where you're able to actually support a nuclear weapons program and start talking seriously, perhaps, about enrichment facilities. What do you do about this? How do you stop this? How do you allow nuclear power plants to go forward, which almost everyone agrees we have to do, and not have this proliferation problem get worse? There's no secret about this. We don't need a think tank study about this. We know what to do. We've known for 62 years. We've known from the very beginning of the nuclear age. Let me take you back. October 1945, this month, 62 years ago, President Harry Truman said in his message to Congress that the hope of civilization lies in international arrangements looking, if possible, to the renunciation of the use and development of the atomic bomb. At that time, he and his 2 international colleagues advanced the world's first nuclear nonproliferation agenda. He was joined by British Prime Minister Clement Attlee and Canadian Prime Minister Mackenzie Keene. These were the only 3 countries in the world who knew how to build nuclear weapons at the time. The U.S. was the only country that had them. We had 4. But Truman could see what was coming. His scientists were advising him of what would happen if you allowed this technology to spread uncontrolled through the world. They proposed to the new United Nations that all atomic weapons, all 4 of them, be eliminated, and that the peaceful purposes for nuclear power be shared under strict international control, implemented by what they termed the UN Atomic Energy Commission. By 1946, they had a detailed plan that included all the things we still talk about: a ban on the production of new weapons, a ban on the production of new fission material, the highly enriched uranium or plutonium, for weapons, a nuclear test ban, complete nuclear disarmament, a system of strict international inspections to inform it, and most importantly for our discussion, the creation of an international mechanism to control the production of nuclear fuel. Bernard Baruch, the conservative New York financier, presented the whole plan to the United Nations a few months later in June 1946, and he detailed a plan that would control what he called the dangerous aspects of the fuel cycle, the uranium mining, the production, the conversion, and the enrichment of uranium, and then the storage of any spent fuel. That would all be handled by an international agency. Countries would be allowed to start nuclear power facilities only under license from this International Atomic Energy Agency. This agency was then established. The commission was established at the United Nations. They approved this plan in December 1946, but it didn't get very far. The Cold War was already starting, and Stalin wanted no part of this deal. He saw Hiroshima as a threat. It has broken the balance, he told his scientists. Build me the bomb. Then our safety will be secured. He thwarted the deal, insisting that the way to proceed was for the U.S. to disarm, and then we would set up these international agreements, knowing that Truman and the others would reject this deal, as they did. The deal foundered, in part, mostly because of Stalin's objections, but in part because there was a growing sense in the United States that we didn't need to make this deal, that we had the bomb, Stalin didn't. And as even Bernard Baruch said, America can get what it wants if she insists on it. After all, we've got it, they haven't. This approach was fatally flawed. It was difficult to see a way out of it at the time, but we can now know historically that these unilateral approaches do not work. We have a 62-year historical record that explains that you can't solve this one nation at a time. You can't solve this by imposing controls or imposing a regime on another country. That strategy doesn't work. What you need is a comprehensive solution that is shared by the major international partners at the time. I see such an international plan emerging. I am very encouraged by what I see. If you look at just what the current situation is, it's bleak. Our proliferation dangers are growing. Iran and North Korea made more progress in their programs in the last 7 years than they made in the previous 12. The international nonproliferation itself is in danger of collapse. The danger of the spread of nuclear power is now bringing with it the danger of new uranium enrichment facilities and plutonium reprocessing facilities. There's still a desire among some states, primarily the United States, to use these nuclear weapons as a club against other nations. But I believe that the policies that have brought us to this current situation have proven themselves to be ineffective, that there's a reason these problems are as bad as they are now, and it's not just because bad things happen, it's because bad policy allows these bad things to happen and, in fact, increases the rate at which they happen. The current policy has failed. This wave has crashed. But there's a new wave coming. There are a dozen initiatives that I know of developing a new non-proliferation strategy, a new nuclear posture, primarily for the United States, but also in other countries. I'm involved in three of them. You see these proposals emerging, most importantly, from George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, William Perry, and Sam Nunn, who a year ago penned an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal calling for a world free of nuclear weapons. They want to revive the notion of elimination of nuclear weapons, something we haven't talked seriously about for over a decade. They know what they're doing. They are fully aware that they are creating a space where politicians can now embrace this cause and the agenda that they've articulated. Just this last week, they met again in a conference at the conservative Hoover Institution, Stanford University, pulling together a team of experts that they've commissioned to detail proposals on their 10-point action plan for how to achieve this world free of nuclear weapons. I was involved in the release last Friday of a new report from a group called the Nuclear Security Advisory Group that details a new nuclear posture for the United States. This was signed by Madeleine Albright, William Perry, John Shalikashvili, Tom Daschle, John Podesta, many of the officials from the previous administration. It details a plan for how to reduce our reliance on nuclear weapons and a solution for solutions for how to proceed to reduce the dangers we face from these weapons. And these solutions are being picked up by leading political figures. So far, it's mostly among the Democrats. The Republicans have not spoken to this in any great detail. But the Democrats have. John Edwards has said that if elected president, he would lead a global compact to eliminate all nuclear weapons. Barack Obama has detailed a plan calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons, ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, a ban on the production of new materials, new negotiations with the Russians to reduce our nuclear stockpiles, and a plan to take all nuclear weapons off of hair trigger alert. Many of our weapons are still poised to fire within 15 minutes or less. Hillary Clinton has embraced a similar plan. She's just published an article in Foreign Affairs that very significantly, for our purposes, calls for she says she would lead a bipartisan effort to seek ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in 2009, which she says the 10th year anniversary of the Senate's initial rejection of this plan. And she calls for the establishment of an international fuel bank to make sure that other countries can know that they can acquire the fuel without having to build facilities of their own. And these are the main alternatives that I see now out there on how to resolve this fuel problem. They basically take the form of fuel assurances, so an international fuel bank like Hillary Clinton or Mohammed al-Baradei is proposing, where countries with the existing capability would sell their fuel to an international authority, say the IAEA. The IAEA would then have possession of that fuel, not literally, not actually, but through contracts, and would then make deals with other countries to supply that fuel. The other proposal is for countries to engage in long-term leasing arrangements for the fuel, what Russia has proposed to Iran. So Russia would produce the fuel, lease it to Iran for use in the reactor, and then reclaim it at the end of that cycle, bringing it back to Russia for disposal, or the creation of an international fuel storage depot. Again, Russia is taking the lead on this. Just this year, they set up a plan for an international uranium enrichment consortium, where they invite other countries to come in and be part of the enrichment process to own a piece of this, and knowing that if they use that fuel, they can then store it back in Russia. There are mechanisms out there for solving this fuel problem, for finally solving the proliferation threat inherent in the spread and development of nuclear power. We have the policies. We have the ideas. What we've been lacking is the leadership with the courage to implement these ideas. I think that's about to change. I think that's about to change not just in the United States, but in the other leading countries of the world. There, we are in the process of a transition of leadership. By next year, by 2009, four of the five members of the Security Council will have new leaders. The UK and France already do. The US and Russia will soon follow. Many other leading nations have recently undergone or are about to undergo a similar transition. Germany, Italy, Australia may very soon. Japan just has. Iran will have a new leader in 2009. It's very unlikely Ahmadinejad will be elected, perhaps Israel as well. What this means is that you have this unprecedented changing of the guard. The G8 summit in 2009 is unlikely to contain a single leader, with the exception of Prime Minister Harper, who was present for the 2006 G8 summit. That means you've got political space opening up. You have the desire of these new leaders to make their mark on the world. They're looking for new ideas. These new ideas are being supplied by the groups and campaigns currently underway, at least in the nuclear field. I think that with this new leadership, with this new moment, we have a chance to take forceful and comprehensive action to solve these two great global threats, the dangers to ourselves, to our children, and our grandchildren. It can be done. We just need the leadership willing to do it. Thank you very much. We have about 15 minutes for coffee and dessert. And while we're doing that, I'm happy to take any questions from the audience. We have a couple of mics going around. Let's start with the gentleman in back.
Hello, I'm Evgeny Pogrebnek from Moscow.
A little louder, please. No, it's on. Just closer.
Evgeny Pogrebnek from Moscow Institute for Complex Strategic Studies. I have a question, please dismiss if it's not meaningful. Is price control on the fuel being part of the non-proliferation agenda? Because as we've seen in the previous presentation,
yeah,
the price of uranium going up, it is not just stimulating more mining of uranium. It's an incentive for the countries that do own nuclear capacity to develop their own fuel processing facility. So a part of the solution, well, some people would argue part of the solution was keeping the price of uranium and the price of the fuel down, so there's no economic incentive for countries to develop their own fuel processing in economic interest. So I was wondering how much of a role that's playing in the non-proliferation agenda.
All the proposals for the International Fuel Bank include proposals to make sure that the fuel is available at competitive rates. To address exactly your point, there has to be financial incentives built into this system so that countries know that it's cheaper to buy the fuel from an international fuel bank than it is to build a facility themselves. It turns out that's very easy to do. The rule of thumb is that it doesn't make economic sense for a country to build its own uranium enrichment facility unless it has about 20 reactors. 20 reactors is about the break-even point. It's because the uranium enrichment facility is very expensive, very difficult to construct. There's nothing easy about this technology. So that's why most countries, in fact, buy the fuel from somebody else. Of the 44 countries that have reactors, almost all of them buy it from some of the five or six uranium providers that are on the market now. And the International Fuel Bank would make sure that it continued to be both assured and financially affordable for the new states. The man next to him.
Can you tell us what really happened in Syria over the past several weeks? And what the dominant incentive for the region to emerge therefrom is? Is it A, that, oh my goodness, Syria was closer than we thought and we must move in that direction too? Or is it B, don't worry, the Israelis will take care of it if anybody comes close, so we can all relax?
Okay. I'm happy to answer that. It's a little off subject, but I'm happy to do it because I've been deeply engaged in this Syria debate for the past, about 6 weeks now. I was very skeptical of any Syrian capability. Syria's had a nuclear program for over 40 years, a very small program. Universities have bigger nuclear programs than Syria has. It's been aided by about a dozen countries, including the United States, who has trained some of the Syrian technicians. And I was very troubled by the way this story was developing. That is, anonymous officials leaking selected pieces of unvetted intelligence to reporters who then put it on the front page of their paper without any attribution, without any verification. I've seen this story before. I don't like the way it ends. In recent days, we've had the first bit of independent evidence surfacing, which is photos taken of the site. And the photos show two things. One, that there was a building in the Syrian site that apparently was the target of the Israeli raid, that looks a lot like the kind of building you would have for a North Korean-style reactor, including a pumping station nearby on the Euphrates River, which is something you would need for cooling of such a reactor. We're talking about a small, relatively small reactor for the purpose of plutonium production, not a power reactor. The second photo that emerged just a couple of days ago, and I commented on it in the New York Times, was a shot of the site now, which shows that the Syrians have scraped it clean there is nothing there. It's like a sandbox. They just wiped it. That is pretty compelling circumstantial evidence, or compelling evidence that they're hiding something. And it starts to tilt it back towards a nuclear reactor. We have a new photo that's just emerged today, and right before I left Washington, I was looking at this one in the New York Times, that the building was actually under construction as early as 2003, which nobody knows exactly what that means. The problem I have with this is not primarily that Syria might have been doing something in violation of its international commitments. If that was a reactor, Syria was not allowed to build it. They should have declared the construction of the reactor in the design phase. As they were thinking about building it, they were obligated to disclose it. If they did not, that's a serious violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The problem I have is with the military strike response to this danger. Even if it was a reactor, it was still some years away from operation. It then takes some years, 18 months to 36 months, to burn fuel in there that could produce plutonium. You need a whole other facility, a plutonium reprocessing facility, to extract the plutonium for a nuclear bomb. In other words, you had years with which to deal with this situation, and we also have an existing mechanism for dealing with it, the IAEA inspection process. If Israel, the United States, suspected this, they should have called the IAEA for inspections. That's the way we responsibly resolve issues like this. Even gross violations like this may have been. A military strike is exactly the wrong way to do it. Did Israel do it because it felt it had an imminent threat? I don't know. Did they do it to send a message to Iran? We don't know. What really went on there, we still don't know. I would like our government leaders, the U.S. leadership, to come and tell us what happened. We live in a democracy. Our leaders should be sharing this information with us, not telling us that a small group of selected officials know what's best for us, and what's best for us is to keep that information secret. This story is still unfolding. I think in a month from now, we'll know a lot more than we do right now. Other questions? Where are you with the mic? There you go, gentleman in back. I'll try to keep my answers shorter so we can take more.
Yeah, I'm the only African here, a dark one. I mean, I'm from a country where there was discrimination and apartheid. Do I smell nuclear apartheid?
Nuclear apartheid.
There are some countries that are mature, that are clever, that can handle nuclear weapons or can control it. But there are some others who are so irresponsible that they shouldn't be allowed. Now, I heard Russia is about to start to maybe improve on theirs. Are they also going to bomb them? Because if a smaller, lesser country does it, we have to take it out. Now, Russia might do it. Are we going to do the same? Or is there some who are responsible? And are they really responsible? Are they behaving in a responsible way that they can be trusted, but not the others?
Okay. Gentleman raises an extremely important point. Do I smell nuclear apartheid, he says. This is the point the Indians have raised for years. So some countries can have nuclear weapons and others can't. And who gets to choose? That's exactly what's wrong with the current policy. We're trying to pick and choose good guys and bad guys. It's okay for India to have nuclear weapons. It's not okay for Iran. It's okay for Israel to have nuclear weapons. It's not okay for Iraq. It's okay for us to have nuclear weapons. It's not okay for North Korea. You can't govern that way. You can't solve the problem that way. For one thing, the good guys and bad guys keep changing. Iran used to be a good guy. The U.S. sold Iran their first reactor. And when they turned into a bad guy, we backed Saddam Hussein, who was our guy against Iran. Pakistan's a good guy now. And I'm telling you, that is the most dangerous country on earth. They have an unstable government. They have enough material for 50 to 60 nuclear weapons. They have strong Islamic fundamentalist influence in their military and intelligence apparatus. They have armed Islamic fundamentalist groups operating on their territory, including Osama bin Laden. What happens if that country topples? What happens if the army splits? Who gets the weapons? Who gets the material? They could go from a major non-NATO ally to our worst nuclear nightmare just like that. That's why the problem is the weapons, wherever they are. The material, wherever it is. That is why you see these card-carrying cold warriors, George P. Shultz, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, and Bill Perry saying we have to eliminate nuclear weapons. They're not doing this from some moral reason. They're doing this from cold, practical calculation. We have to eliminate all these weapons, and we can do it now. The Cold War is over. We can walk down that non-nuclear path together. And by eliminating these weapons, at least making the initial steps to do it, cutting the U.S. and Russian arsenals, passing the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, establishing a nuclear fuel bank, ending the production of fissile material, you're in a much stronger position to convince other countries that they shouldn't acquire these weapons. It's got to be one rule for all. We are a nation of laws. We should want to live in a world for laws, and those laws have to be universally applied. Thank you. I'm told I still have a couple of minutes. Let's try to get it, and then we'll get to you.
Thank you. The idea of a nuclear international nuclear fuel bank is very attractive. Earlier this morning, Louise Frochette made the comment that the reason why we don't have stronger international energy agencies or organizations is because it's so vitally linked access to energy to national security. What would build the trust necessary for a significant number of states to want to, in a world in which they're building more reactors and they're more and more dependent for their future electricity supply on nuclear power, to trust an international fuel bank when, I don't mean to be pejorative, but when, as you said, good guys mean bad guys, in a world in which even large democratic powers like the United States can change their policies and attitudes towards individual governments. I mean, if you're a gut-level decision-maker in a middle power, be it in Iran or even a Canada or Australia, you know, could you actually tell your own public, for the next 40 years, we can be absolutely confident that nobody's going to mess with the rules of this particular fuel bank, and that's where we're going to get our uranium from?
That's why exactly. So the issue is, can you really assure fuel? And this is what Iran is saying. Iran is saying, we want the energy of the future. You tell us it's the energy of the future. We're going for the energy. The Shah had a program to build 20 reactors. We're just picking up where he left off. You approved it then. Why don't you approve it now? We're having problems with Russia. Russia hasn't delivered the fuel for the Bushehr reactor, which is a good thing. But it does prove their point. We can't get a reliable fuel supply. That's why you have to have an international mechanism for doing so. But it's not, you know, and this thing, that's why you have to have a comprehensive policy. It's not a matter of some fix that you can have here, some fuel bank fix, one negotiation on Russia. It has to be multi-leveled. So how do you get countries to have assurances? You also have to deal with the underlying conflicts in the region that give rise to their insecurity. So you have to do serious conflict resolution. That means you've got to find a way to bring Iran into a Middle East security arrangement. That means you've got to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That means you have to be marching to eliminate our own nuclear weapons so they see that you're practicing what you preach. In other words, you got to play this three-dimensional chess on all levels at the same time, because every move on that level affects a move on this level. Can we do that? Of course we can do that. Of course we can do that. What I'm describing, Middle East peace, is a daunting proposition. But in my lifetime, I've seen chemical and biological weapons be removed from major arsenals. We no longer count on these. I've seen the Soviet Union fall. I've seen Germany unite. I've seen Vietnam unite. I've seen the Red Sox win the World Series. Don't you tell me it's not possible. Of course it is. We just have to be pursuing that goal. One more question. They might even do it again.
Actually, my question was very similar to the last one. I mean, we're sitting in the Center for International Governance Innovation, and I think you've thrown out a fabulous challenge to the scholars here, which is to really think about what, and I guess my question to you is, where would you begin in thinking about the two or three elements of your international fuel bank that would give confidence to the key members to be part of it? I mean, I think by analogy about the International Monetary Fund, right? An international, monetary fund, and the way in which the governance of that organization based in Washington and seen as overly U.S.-dominated has led to India, China, Korea, Indonesia, South Africa, in essence walking away, not trusting it, setting up their own arrangements, losing confidence in it.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to think, what for you would be the two or three things about an international fuel bank which would give people confidence that it wasn't going to be that?
Two things. In addition to the conflict resolution, I mean, you have to... There has to be a balanced board in charge of it, so a board that people trust. So the decision's not up to the great powers, but it's up to, say it's the IAEA, an agency that most countries already trust. So that's one thing. But the real answer, I think, is multiple approaches. That it's not just the fuel bank where people can get their fuel. There's also other alternatives. And that they should be tried simultaneously. John Deutsch and Ernie Moniz and Ani Cantor and Dan Poneman, two Republicans, two Democrats, wrote a great article a couple of years ago describing how you could have a system of contracts, interlocking contracts. There's a business model for how you could do this that doesn't depend on an international agency for how to assure supply. There's also, that's number two. Number three is you set up multinational fuel consortia. So not an international, but a multinational. This is the way Europe gets its fuel. You know, they go through Urenco. Urenco is run by, it's a uranium enrichment corporation. It's run by Germany, United Kingdom, and Belgium. And no one nation controls it. In fact, after the AQCon scandals, AQCon worked for Urenco and stole the centrifuges, they now actually segment the processes. So no one nation controls the entire process. Very interesting. So these plants are located in individual countries, but no one country controls them. So you could imagine a Middle East fuel consortium. This is what Russia's talking about setting up there. It's set it up. It holds a 90% share now. I think it's Kazakhstan owns 10%. Japan has shown interest in buying 10%. Russia's inviting Iran to buy 10%. So you have an international consortium that you're a piece of. So your country is part of that consortium. So that's another way to do it. And you could, if we're talking about the kind of expansion that some people envision, 700 plants, two new plants every month, you're going to need all of these. You're going to need all of these. So that's the way to do it. You know, you might think of it as, you know, backup plans. So if one fails, the other one will still be there. I think we have to end right now, sir. You tell me, can I take this one last question? Go. Thank you, and then we'll go. The other panel's supposed to start now.
Thank you. You've been very eloquent. I'm sitting next to Mohammed Shaker. He and I, we're both members.
You should be up here talking about this.
Okay. Hans Blix Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction. And I think what you said is eminently possible. I don't see the possibility of success. But we must start by temporary, limited, confidence-building measures. First one is to get the NPT at one of its review conferences at least adopt one paragraph, one line, one sentence, which has failed to do. Second, we must get the Conference on Disarmament at least to accept an agenda and to start some kind of ball rolling. What I think we have is that you mentioned promises in the past, the Baruch Plan, Atoms for Peace, Truman, Eisenhower, and you said that perhaps a newer U.S. administration will be open for change. The weak point in your argument is that at present, none of that exists.
Yes.
So we either must look back for inspiration or future for hope. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to supplement what Marcus has just said. And I believe that the solution rests in the in allowing the participation, a larger participation of countries in the making of the new regime that you are talking of. For example, the question of supply, assurances of supply. The users or the recipients don't want to remain always recipients, always. They want to have a share in the decision made, which may affect their well-being and affect their welfare. And therefore, I think we have to increase the participation, the decision-making on in the new regime that you're talking about should be enlarged, and it would not be based only on the wishes of the big powers and the influential and the industrial nation. It has to be built also on the participation of the smallest countries that one day may need the material, may need the equipment to have their own nuclear power. And therefore, in a nutshell, we have to increase the participatory. It's not only the assurance supply, but also the participatory aspect is very important.
That's absolutely right, and I don't know if there's a rule of global governance that says that, but it should, that everybody has to buy into it, that the small nations matter just as much as the large nations. I mean, how much more do we need to be educated on this issue when the greatest nation in the world really does have to worry what a crazy man is thinking in a cave in Afghanistan? You know, you cannot ignore the needs, the desires, the plans of the smallest of nations. That's why I'm encouraged by what I see in the policy world, what I see developing. When I see what Barack Obama said, when I see what Hillary Clinton saying, that they are in favor of starting a process to ratify the comprehensive test ban treaty. When I go around the world and I ask other countries, what's the single thing the United States can do? That's what they say. Ratify the CTBT. Bang. We got to be ready in the first year of a new administration to get that done. And then we have to have four or five other things to do. We got to get ready for the 2010 NPT review conference. We have to have all this lined up. And I'm telling you, people are working on this. I'm working on a project for the group called the World Security Institute that wants to launch a global summit in 2010, right before the NPT review conference, sort of a Davos process, to get lots of people involved, not just politicians, but other people involved in this. I was out in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago talking to the producers who made An Inconvenient Truth. They want to make a nuclear Inconvenient Truth. You know, there are some serious efforts underway. That's to develop the new policy. That's why I'm telling you, a new wave is coming here. I see it forming. I see it happening. We're going to have about a 2 or 3 year window to make this change. This doesn't come around very often. We're lucky to be here at this moment. We can't blow it. We can't blow it. I'm confident that we're going to make the change that all of us want. And then I'm going to come back here on the 10th anniversary and we'll be celebrating our successes. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you today. Thank you very much.